Welcome to another episode of Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy. I'm your host, Cliff Davis. Joining me in the studio today for this episode of Always and Forever Chester is Naval History and Heritage Command historian Tyler Bamford, contributing author to the NHHC publication, Best Beloved, The Wartime Letters of Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz to his wife, Catherine. Thank you for coming in today to speak about your book, and how are you doing?
Thanks very much for having me, Cliff. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm doing fantastic.
Your book presents something from the NHHC archives that many may not have known existed, but it's all the surviving letters from World War II that Admiral Nimitz wrote to his wife, Catherine, starting in December of 1941, through his nervous excitement of signing the surrender documents that ended the most destructive war in the 20th century. What did it mean to you to be assigned this task of writing this book?
You know, it was a tremendous honor and privilege. When I first came to the Naval History and Heritage Command in 2021 from the National World War II Museum, I had known of Chester Nimitz. I knew the Pacific War very well, but I did not know him personally as a man on a very, you know, intimate level, reading his correspondence. And so being assigned this project to really draw out who he was and show that to the broader public was really a privilege.
The letters offer an intimate glimpse into Nimitz's life and who he was with and who he was around throughout the war. How did you figure out a way to balance the need to respect his privacy with the historical significance of the documents?
Well, that's a great question. And it is important to remember that these letters are very personal. They were the very intimate thoughts of Admiral Nimitz that he was sharing with his wife. He did not expect these letters to be read by anyone else, and she did not, at the time that she received them, expect to be sharing them with anyone else. But as time progresses, I think that their attitudes towards the letters would have changed. Certainly, Mrs. Nimitz's attitudes did change, because after her husband's death, she chose to preserve these letters for posterity and donate 73 of the complete letters to the predecessor organization of the Naval History and Heritage Commands, the Naval Historical Center at the time. And there were letters, however, that she felt had content that was very sensitive. And for those letters, she copied down in her own hand portions of the letters that she felt was significant and left out many lines of those letters. For the rest of those, she burned those letters. And so when she donated those letters, that was her way of saying, it's okay. I want people to know my husband in the future. I want them to know this way. And there was a long period, too, of respecting the family's privacy and leaving these letters, you know, in the archive, available to researchers, but also somewhat difficult to get to. And that's why I think these letters have been occasionally quoted by authors in prominent books about the Pacific Theater and World War II, but not so much so that you really get that sense of who Admiral Nimitz was at a personal level, and now they can do so. So when we went to publish these letters, we looked carefully over a lot of the content, and some of the content that would have been very sensitive in 1941, 42 through 45, about their finances, about their family's health, it no longer was anymore. And a lot of the expressions that at the time would have been considered a bit awkward about Nimitz saying to his wife, you know, how much he adored her, how much he loved her. Well, that would have been to Victorian sensibilities, which, you know, you have to remember that Admiral Nimitz grew up in the 1880s, 1890s, would have been somewhat uncomfortable just to have this published, you know, that you're sharing this with your wife. But today, it gives so much more depth to his character and to our understanding of him and how devoted he was to his wife and what this relationship meant to him in his career and to sustain him through these absences, too.
Did you encounter any ethical dilemmas when editing these personal files and or letters, and how did you navigate those challenges?
Well, I'll give you the most glaring and obvious example is right on the front of the book. It's Best Beloved. Now, this term was the term of endearment that Chester called Catherine. This was his pet name for her, Best Beloved, Best Belle. And this was something that they probably wouldn't have gone around in public calling each other, let's just put it that way. And in the letters that survived, that Catherine Nimitz chose to preserve, she at one point used white out and whited over that phrase specifically. And this was the phrase that he started each letter, Best Beloved. So that was all, you know, covered over in the letters and still is to this day. However, even in her own lifetime, I think her attitude about letting that be known and made public changed, because there was an oral history that she recorded after her husband's death, but obviously, you know, before she donated these letters to the Naval Archive, in which she read one of the letters out loud, and she left that phrase in the letter. She read that out loud for the record, for posterity. And so that is how we kind of reconciled any reservations we might have had, and saying, you know, we want the world to know that they loved each other. And also, I think she would want that too. And certainly, since the letters have been published, I think it was great relief to myself and everyone else who worked on this project. We've heard from the family. We've spoken to them, the Admiral and his wife's grandchildren now. And they've said that they really feel that these letters add so much depth to the Admiral's character. And they're so thankful that we have made these available for the public.
You're talking about the families and trying to keep privacy and then the ethical dilemmas. But what were some of the most significant editorial decisions you made in shaping the narrative and overall flow of this book?
So when you're creating an edited collection of documents, you know, it seems like a very straightforward process. And in fact, I mean, you've got 73 letters and 75 fragments of letters, give or take. Okay, we're going to arrange these chronologically. That's the most obvious organization. That's all well and good, although there are a couple fragments that are undated. So we had to carefully place those and indicate, too, that we believe this is where they were between the couple. The other issues, however, is that there's large gaps in the correspondence. Now, Admiral Nimitz and his wife would have written to each other virtually every day for four years, really. However, there's in the correspondence that we have, there's at least, let's say, a year or two complete missing. Most of 1943, most of 1944 is missing in the correspondence. So the temptation was there for us to add explanatory text in between the letters, saying, okay, this is what was happening at this period. This is, you know, maybe what would have been in the letters had they survived. But then we stepped back and we said, you know what? The focus needs to be on the Admiral's words to his wife, to Catherine, and we don't want to interrupt the flow. We don't want to interject. So instead, when arranging the volume, we wrote a new short biography of Admiral Nimitz and put that at the front of the volume. We put a chronology of his life, major significant professional and family events that took place during the war at the beginning of the volume, so that readers, if they want to, they can reference that. If they get disoriented at all, if there's missing those gaps that they want to fill in, they can do so. But other than that, the majority of the book is just readers are going to see the Admiral's words to his wife.
So you just mentioned explanatory notes, but what other kinds of annotations did you include to provide context for the readers?
So another thing when you're editing documents for publication is you want your readers to be able to understand the historical actors who wrote this we're talking about. Now, Admiral Nimitz and his wife, they had a kind of shorthand. They had abbreviations for people, for places. And the average reader, if they pick one of these letters up, there's going to be a lot of questions. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't a lot of extra effort and legwork for our readers, whether they be scholars or naval personnel today, or just a casual, you know, history buffs, to understand what was going on. So to account for that, we put 660 some annotations in the book. So that's many annotations for each letter, which with a superscript and just at the end of the letter, just explaining who the people, the places, the things that are being referenced, who they are. And not just, okay, this was, you know, Admiral so-and-so, Admiral Halsey, whatever, but also explaining this is what that admiral's job was at the time, or that this enlisted sailor, Nimitz, he loved placing the names of everyone he talked to in his letters. He was a very extroverted people person, I think. And so he had a large network of friends all over the country. If he received letters from them, he would let his wife know. If he received gifts, he would let her know, you know, what he was doing, who he was talking to, what he was seeing. And so this way, our readers will have all that information preserved for posterity. And that was a lot of sleuthing, a lot of detective work to find out and figure out who he was referring to in some instances. But we're very confident that we've done so to a high degree of accuracy now for posterity.
So earlier you mentioned that Admiral Nimitz expected his wife to destroy the letters, but what were some of the surrounding circumstances that Catherine decided to preserve some of the correspondence?
To our understanding, when Admiral Nimitz and his wife were corresponding during the war, they both agreed, or it was common understanding between them, that they would destroy each other's letters because these were very sensitive letters and sometimes would have things that they really wouldn't want to be made known to the public, especially at the time, or made known to really anybody beyond the two of them, because these letters were really their outlet to each other. It was a way to vent their frustrations, share their innermost thoughts. And sure enough, Admiral Nimitz, as far as we know, did destroy all of his wife's letters to him during the war, when he could have saved them, mind you, because he was in a rear area. He could have boxed them up, put them away. And she destroyed most of his correspondence as well. But then many, many years later, forgotten in a shoebox in a closet, she discovered that not all the letters, that many of the letters, in fact, from at least 2 to 3 years worth had been forgotten, and she rediscovered them. She looked them over, and it was at this point that she carefully noted down, I should say, fragments of some of the letters. And then after she had taken down what she considered to be significant, probably historically significant, including letters from very important time periods, including June 2nd, 1942, right before the Battle of Midway. One of Chester Nimitz's letters from then, we know she had it, and we know she also destroyed it after copying down just a single tantalizing line from that one letter. But she destroyed most of them. Then she decided not to destroy, however, about 73 of these letters. And I think at that point, what was going through her head was, you know what, actually, these are historically significant. Maybe this was near the time when her husband was getting much older. Maybe he was getting sick, as he did in the last year or so of his life, had a lot of health difficulties. Or maybe it was right after he passed away. And at that point, she decided to save these for posterity. And in fact, there's actually burn marks on one of the surviving letters. And so it's very interesting to think, you know, maybe she had a second thought in the process of destroying a letter. We can't know for sure, but it is interesting to think of that. And then, so she decided to save either the original letters after she kind of whited out some portions of them, or she saved parts of other letters by copying them down in her own hand before destroying the originals. It was herself and then her children who, over the course of several decades from 1966 to 1982, donated the letters to the Naval Historical Center.
How do these letters contribute to the understanding of not only the strategic challenges of the Navy, but Nimitz faced while in the Pacific?
So it's kind of difficult to read into these letters what's going on in the strategy of the Pacific War, because obviously Nimitz is privy to the most secret U.S. war plans and movements of its units, things that absolutely cannot be shared. And so, you know, even though he might know a certain action is going on or coming up, like the Battle of Midway, he certainly can't tell his wife. He sometimes will drop hints to her saying like, oh, there's big goings on out west, watch the newspapers. But other times, if you read between the lines, especially with the benefit of hindsight, we can see how the strategy of the U.S. is playing out. And through the eyes of the leader of the U.S. Pacific Fleet and through his emotional state, I would even say, in January 1942, there was one night, January 12th, where Nimitz wrote that he was going to bed early because he hadn't slept well the night before. Well, if you look in the record of the war now, we know that the carrier Saratoga had been torpedoed the day before, and he didn't know if that ship was going to survive or not. So, yeah, obviously he wouldn't have slept very well at all, thinking maybe, you know, maybe thousands of men were going to perish. Maybe his one of the most valuable assets under his command, a valuable U.S. carrier, was going to the bottom. Now, it turns out the Saratoga did make it, and he would have known that by the next day the ship was going to limp into Pearl Harbor. But in instances like that, you can kind of see. And I'll give you another example. Early in the war, too, when things were going pretty badly for the United States, he shared with his wife in one letter that he would be lucky to last 6 months in this position. And that's a really surprising thing to read from Admiral Nimitz. Admiral Nimitz today is this, you know, resoundingly triumphant figure in U.S. naval history. I mean, he ranks with the very top U.S. admirals of the Navy's entire history. But to see him be unsure that he's going to last because he felt that he might not be able to deliver results as fast as the people demanded it. And that was simply because he didn't have the ships, he didn't have the men to really throw against the Japanese onslaught in Southeast Asia at that particular time. So he was unsure, you know, what was going to happen. And so you kind of see things like that. We've also kind of tried to draw out in the annotations too, and to kind of explain and highlight, kind of signpost those instances.
Now, do the letters shed any light about Nimitz's relationships with other combatant commanders in the area or key figures of the war?
They do in a couple instances. They are surprisingly generally silent about Nimitz's relationship with Ernest King, the chief of naval operations, but Nimitz does mention General Douglas MacArthur, who was kind of his counterpart in the Southwest Pacific during the war. And Nimitz and MacArthur had to coordinate their efforts on multiple occasions. Nimitz would mention in his letters to Catherine that he'd lent his ships to MacArthur and that he wished MacArthur a lot of success because he wanted those ships back for his own operations. And Nimitz would sometimes vent his frustration to Catherine that the newspapers, he said, were creating or inventing or fabricating strife or disagreements between himself and MacArthur where none existed. They were creating a feud in his mind. And that was very frustrating to Nimitz because Nimitz was very much a joint commander. He really wanted to promote good relations between all of the service branches. And that was the team that he forged, you know, that was at its very cores, a Marine Corps, Army Air Corps, Army, and Coast Guard team even. And so when he writes to Catherine, you usually don't see a lot of disagreement, except until the last part of the war when they have to, Nimitz and MacArthur, that is, they have to unscramble their forces because MacArthur was going to be named, he was going to command all of the Army forces in the Pacific for the invasion of Japan, and Nimitz was going to command all of the Navy forces. And so that was going to be a very difficult command arrangement to sort out because their forces were so enmeshed as a joint team beforehand. I will say there is one other caveat to that, is that a lot of the letters that we don't have from 1943 and 44 are from this period where MacArthur, who was a very charming individual in person and who got along very well with Nimitz, where MacArthur, however, behind Nimitz's back, was kind of agitating and kind of spreading rumors to the media saying that, you know, that this should be a more of an Army show in the Pacific, that he should have command of all the ground forces. So we don't have Nimitz's letters from then. And if there was, if Nimitz was venting to his wife at that point, that's probably when he would have done it.
In your reviewing the letters, did you uncover any unexpected connections or historical insight while researching the correspondence between Nimitz and his wife?
One of the most interesting things that I had no idea about when I started the project, and even when I read several biographies about Nimitz, was that Catherine, his wife, she came from a very old New England family, and her brother was actually killed aboard the Lusitania when it was sunk in 1915 by a German submarine during World War I. And I thought that this was particularly interesting, not only because of the tense emotional aspect of this and the pain that this caused Catherine's family at the time, which was evident in an oral history that she gave. So it's not in the letters during World War II. So Catherine's brother, was Richard Freeman, was killed by a German submarine when Catherine's husband, Chester Nimitz, at that time a lieutenant, he was one of the foremost submariners in the U.S. Navy, and he became a major proponent and advocate of submarine warfare. So we don't have any letters that survive from this time period, but it'd be interesting when you think about losing a family member to this, what was at the time considered a kind of outlaw way of war, really. In the United States, the sinking of the Lusitania became a major public outrage. It incited outrage among the population. And so maybe it would have called into question, too, you know, the role of submarines in warfare, too, for some Americans, for some of the Navy. But yeah, having this be Nimitz's specialty at this point in his career, too, must have been rather interesting.
How did Nimitz's letters portray the cost of war for both sides of the war, for American and Japanese forces?
I think several of them do, and I'm thinking especially of one letter where Nimitz visits the island of Tarawa, and he is seeing still, this was only a couple days after the battle, the island had been secured by the Marines, and he's visiting it with other generals and officers on his staff, and he remarks in his letters to Catherine that the stench is just incredible from the bodies that are yet unburied. And he says that one of the officers whom he's with, who had seen the battlefields in World War I, says that it reminds him exactly of these battlefields. And there's other letters, too, where Nimitz mentions receiving angry letters signed a Marine mother, saying, accusing him of causing their son's death. And Nimitz took this very hard. He knew that this was his job and this was his position. And he said to Catherine, you know, I don't know how I could have prevented the casualties. I feel very distraught about it. I feel very bad about it. And I think in those types of letters that you see that Nimitz wasn't a detached commander. He did try to get up front and visit the troops whenever he could. In fact, he moved his whole headquarters up to Guam in early 1945, and just with that goal in mind. And so we see in these letters that he was a very empathetic leader, and he did try to stay in touch with his men, and he did understand the human cost. His own son was serving on a submarine in the Southwest Pacific, which was one of the most dangerous roles that you could have in World War II, and especially in the Navy. And so he was, I think, acutely aware of the risks and of the personal toll. Several of the officers with whom he met and spoke, was friends with, they had lost sons who were serving. And Nimitz also had several officers who he was good friends with who were killed in the war. And so he mentions those occasionally in the letters as well. So you really do get the sense that this is a major upheaval and also a major time of danger for everyone, so many people who he knows and so many people, and even people in his family, including his own son.
How did Nimitz's personal experience, such as his childhood in Texas and early Navy career in submarines and such, shape his worldview and his approach to leadership?
What I discovered reading about Nimitz as a young man growing up in Texas was two things really stuck out to me. And one is his curiosity about the world, and the other is his work ethic. And from a young age, he had to go to work to help his family. Nimitz's biological father passed away before Nimitz was born. And so his mother remarried, and he did have several step-siblings, but he had to go to work at a very young age to help support his family. He worked in a hotel in Kerrville, Texas. And when he was at the hotel, he got to see a lot of people passing through, some historical figures, some Civil War veterans. He saw other current active duty service members from the Army predominantly. And I think that awakened in him a curiosity for the outside world. And I think, too, what encouraged him to pursue a career in the military. At first, he wanted to go to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point because he wanted also an education. He wanted to learn as much as he could, and he wanted to do something significant with his life. When he was unable to get an appointment to West Point, he redirected his ambition to securing an appointment to the Naval Academy, which he did through competitive examination. And at the Naval Academy, I think several major historical events kind of influenced his future leadership, one of which was the aftermath of the Spanish-American War. And he saw this controversy called the Sampson-Schley controversy, which was a very public and heated debate over which admiral was more responsible for the U.S. victory at the Battle of Santiago Bay. And Nimitz saw these naval officers kind of disparaging one another in public, and that really turned him off. And he thought that the Navy and, you know, the military in general shouldn't air its dirty laundry in public. So he became a very reserved officer and very conscious officer when it came to ever leveling criticism at fellow officers in public or even in anything that could become public, whether it was reports or anything like that. So he became very, very reserved in that regard. He requested duty right after graduating from the Naval Academy in the Far East, which was kind of the most exciting posting you could get in the Navy at the time. Maybe not the best on the surface for career advancement that it would seem anyway. On the other hand, it gave him and a lot of other young officers who later excelled and rose to prominence in World War II the opportunities for early command. So Nimitz, he went out to the Far East. He received command of a gunboat in the Philippines at first, and then later at the age of just 22 years old, he commanded a destroyer, the destroyer Decatur. And so Nimitz is out there. He's really running his own show. He's got command of a destroyer. And on this destroyer, he performs very well. He goes through, in fact, a typhoon, survives that. He writes in letters that are now in the collections of the National Museum of the Pacific War down in Texas about surviving 40 and 50 feet swells that would wash over the decks of the ship. A very, very exciting time period. So he survives all that. And just a couple months before he's supposed to rotate back to the United States, he's looking forward to that. One night, calm seas in the Philippines, the Decatur runs aground. And that is the nightmare of every sailor, and particularly every commanding officer of a Navy ship. Running aground is usually the death knell of a career. So the Decatur actually isn't damaged. It's pulled off of this uncharted sandbar or mud bank the next day by a passing steamer. Nimitz gets into port, and he reports it. He's that conscientious officer. He reports that my ship ran aground. Immediately, a court of inquiry, a court-martial is convened, and Nimitz calls one of a brother officer, a friend, to help him with his defense, which is his right. He defends himself before the board of officers, and he is found not guilty of neglect of duty, but he is kind of found guilty of a lesser charge. And in lieu of a sentence, really just given a public reprimand, which the publishing of the court proceedings really serves as. And Nimitz, at this point, you know, I'm not sure what he might have felt about whether this was career ending or something like that. His next posting was with submarines. And that, too, wasn't usually viewed as the way to high command through the submarine branch. So maybe he felt that he was being punished in a way, but he also viewed this sentence and his ability to maintain his rank and keep an upward trajectory as a second chance. And this became a central tenet of his command philosophy, was to give second chances and appreciate them and to conserve talent for the Navy. And so Nimitz, when he becomes the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, what does he do with his predecessor, Admiral Husband Kimmel's staff? He says to all of them, he says, "We've just suffered a grave defeat here, but I want all of you to stay on who wish to to help avenge that defeat. And that this is a second chance because they all think that about to get relieved, you know, ignominiously from duty. And that really says a lot about Nimitz because he knew that he didn't just have to rebuild the fleet physically and oversee that, but he also had to rebuild the morale. And he was a very gifted leader of people. And that's, too, I think, one of his outstanding characteristics that shows up in these letters, too, especially, but seeing his war record, that's definitely one of the biggest things. He was also, going back to his thirst for knowledge, he was always learning. And in the Navy, when you change postings every couple of years, you're usually thrown into a new job about which you know nothing. You have to learn on the fly. And he was very good at that. And he wasn't just willing to do it. He was eager to do it. He threw himself into the submarines when that became a common posting for him in the 1920s. He learned everything he could. He wrote an article about it that was published in Proceedings. And then during World War II, as a fleet admiral, he's still learning. He wants to know about intelligence because this is the way of the future. But Nimitz, when he would have a couple spare minutes, would go to the rooms where the code breakers were working. He would stand and watch over their shoulder and just try to observe. He said, don't stop what you're doing. I just want to learn. Sometimes the code breakers would stop and explain to him what they were doing. And he was very interested in that. And I think his willingness and openness to learn new things, that was a game changer for his command. And in the Battle of Midway, when he took his code breakers of Station Hypo, led by Joseph Rochefort, when he took their word for the assessment of what the Japanese fleet was about to do, that changed the course of 1942 in the Pacific.
Okay, so now how would you describe Admiral Nimitz's personality and his character based on his letters to Catherine?
So I've already talked a little bit about his command personality and his command philosophy, right? But there was another side to Nimitz that didn't always come out among his subordinates, among his colleagues, and things that do shine through in the letters, especially to Catherine. One was obviously his loyalty to her and how much he valued her. He was a very doting man on his wife, very concerned over her health. He trusted her immensely. They were truly partners. And in fact, in several times in the letters, you'll see him say to her, handle the finances as best as you think, you know, and if you think that we should buy more stocks or we should buy more war bonds, then do that. You know, if you see an attractive piece of land for us to build our home after the war, then absolutely go and buy it. If you think that we should sell the car, I trust you. Go ahead and do whatever you think is best for us. And I think this will resonate too with any Navy family because there does have to be this kind of trust. And when Nimitz was leading the Pacific Fleet, he couldn't be also managing his own family affairs and family finances. So he did rely on his partner and his wife, Catherine. He was extremely proud of his family and of Catherine's accomplishments, especially. She spoke regularly in war bond drives and to volunteer organizations during the war. She volunteered herself for the Navy Relief Society at the U.S. Naval Hospital at Oakland as a administrator. What her job was, her actual job, was to oversee and disperse grants to Navy families who were in financial difficulties because, for whatever reason, their members needed hospitalization. So she would oversee the disbursement of funds to those who needed it the most, which was such an important job. And when, at the end of the war, when her time and that role was concluded and she was retiring or leaving or whatever you want to call it, there was going to be a party. And she wrote to Nimitz, and we can infer that she wrote to Nimitz, we don't have the letter, that she wrote to him saying that, you know, I wish you could be here, Chester, to see this. And he wrote back to her, he said, no, I'm really glad this time, as much as I want to be there and celebrate with you, I'm really glad that you will be able to get all this honor for yourself because you deserve it. And I think that says a lot about Nimitz's humility that he didn't want to take away from this accomplishment from his wife. Some other things that show up in the letters, too, his sense of humor. Sometimes a little bit off-color jokes, but he had a great sense of humor. He loved to laugh. He loved hearing jokes, telling stories, and you can kind of see that several times in the letters. Nimitz was a very self-aware guy, and he knew what he was good at without being egotistical and without feeling the need to build himself up at the expense of others. And that, too, I think shows through in the letters because he's constantly praising the works of others, not just his wife, but fellow officers, and just saying what great things that they're doing for the Navy, saying when he is forced to make hard decisions that he really hopes that he's not creating enemies. And he's a very generous guy, too. I think we see in the letters that he mentions giving gifts away because, you know, people are too generous to him and he wants to spread this, pass on this good fortune. So there's a lot of different elements of his personality that really come through when you read these letters.
So within all the letters, were you able to get a sense of Admiral Nimitz and his hopes, his fears for the future, for himself, and even for his family?
Absolutely. There were two elements that I think really shone through in the letters about Nimitz thinking of the future. And he did. He thought about the future a lot, which is kind of surprising. You'd think that he would be really wrapped up in the war. But in fact, he was also just like all of us. You know, he's dreaming of retirement, dreaming of that day when he could be back with his wife. And what he would describe to her was his vision for buying a house, the two of them, and retiring in California, I think Berkeley especially. And so he told her, like, if you see, you know, an attractive house or land, whatever, go ahead and buy it. And she did, in fact, buy it. But also, in addition to that, he was also constantly always keeping track of their financial security. And in addition to just the practical aspects of planning for retirement, he also looked ahead to his next job, which was the Navy way, right? At the end of World War II, Nimitz hoped to be appointed as Chief of Naval Operations, the very pinnacle of the Navy. He hoped to do so. And why did he hope to do that? To protect what he was and his sailors were fighting for in the Pacific. He wanted to be CNO so that he could ensure that the Navy held on to and developed the island bases and possessions that they had acquired during World War II in order to best protect U.S. interests and U.S. security in the Pacific. So in that respect, these are topics that show up in the letters themselves. We can see Nimitz, you know, planning for the future as much as being focused on the present war, whether it's thinking about being able to send his daughter Mary to college or where they might get a home and whether they would be near friends or where their next assignment's going to be, and hopefully in Washington, D.C., as he wrote to her. Yeah, so we see that a lot.
Now, how do the letters portray the challenges and rewards of maintaining a strong marriage through wartime separation? They're sending these letters back and forth. Is there anything that stood out to you that kind of reinforce their marriage?
So there are certain things in these letters that will be familiar to anyone familiar with maintaining a long-distance correspondence, especially over this medium, or someone who's read other World War II letters back and forth. And that is the challenge of communicating with this medium. Nimitz and Catherine's letters took anywhere between 3 and 7 days to reach each other. And Nimitz, you know, had the benefit of being at a stationary post, and you know, he was in Hawaii, and so there was regular mail delivery. That's pretty standard. Even so, though, when you're writing a letter to someone every day and you're responding to their letters, you're often actually maintaining multiple conversations with that person, and you're talking past each other. Sometimes there would be instances where it's like, oh, you wrote this on this day, and I wrote this on this about that same topic on this day. We must have been thinking the same thing. We must be on the same wavelength. But really, just sharing words with each other. And it doesn't even really matter what it's about. If it's just, you know, I'm doing fine today. I went out, I ate some this at lunch, et cetera. It might not look significant, but it's creating that feeling of closeness and sharing your life with another person. And so that support that they were able to offer each other was incredibly important. And just expressing that care for one another's safety. And there was danger too, even in Nimitz's service, because when he flew back to California, in one instance, his plane actually crashed in San Francisco Bay. It hit a piece of debris as it was landing, and it crashed, and the pilot or the co-pilot was killed in that accident. Nimitz himself survived with just minor injuries, but there was still a great deal of cause for concern for Catherine of Nimitz's flying during the war. Several planes carrying high-ranking officers went missing over the Pacific, and to this day we have no idea what happened to them, but their officers died. The commander of U.S. Navy submarines in the Pacific, his plane went down at one point and he was killed. So there was this need too. There was this anxiety that they both had to kind of get out and share with each other and be supported during their wartime separation.
Now, the letters for Catherine, they don't survive, but what can we learn about her personality and her role in supporting her husband through his letters and how he's replying back to her?
Yeah, it's really a shame that her letters don't survive, because she would have had such a unique perspective on this, and she was such an incredible woman. And it's funny, actually, you see in the letters sometimes where they both, Admiral Nimitz says, oh, I wish my letters were better. And then he will also reassure her that her letters are fantastic, which to me says that she must have said something similar to him. But Catherine was, as I said, a very, very strong and by necessity an independent woman. She moved her household, herself and her 10-year-old daughter, Mary, across the country from Washington, D.C. to California after her husband had been dispatched to Hawaii to take command of the Pacific Fleet. She moved herself and her daughter across the country. She lived in California before, but it had been 15 years, so she had to renew old friendships. She had to find a place to live for a while. She was staying in a hotel. And But the fact that she did that, she reestablished her life there and then immediately set to work supporting the war effort. All at a time when she was under increased media scrutiny, reporters would approach her and ask her, you know, personal things about her life. And she would just demur. And she'd say that an admiral's wife and family are not important enough. No need to print anything about us. And so we can imply that she was humble, but she had a lot of interests that come through in Nimitz's letters, because he mentions that her love of painting. I think the fact that he talks to her so much about music implies that she also enjoyed music. And we do have an oral history that she recorded 20 years after the war. And thankfully, so we do have her perspective on some of these events and her husband too. So we're not completely taking shots in the dark here and guessing at her. But she was a really incredible person. And just supporting her husband's career, she gave up a lot. And that's nothing that's going to sound unfamiliar to military families. But she was in college when she met Lieutenant Nimitz, and so she left college. I'm not sure what her plans were for her career, but certainly that all changed. When they met, they got married, and then she raised 4 children, moving all over the world. Their honeymoon I call it their honeymoon, but really it was his assignment to Europe to study diesel engines in Germany and other places, naval technology. And then she lived in the Far East for a time in Japan and in China with her children, and the Philippines, she spent time there as well, following her husband's deployments. So the Nimitzes actually had a better World War II in terms of how much they got to see each other than most sailors did. They had it better. And so we can't overplay how difficult they had it, the degree of difficulty which their separation led to, because they were actually able to see each other every couple months when Nimitz would fly back to Washington, D.C. or California for conferences with his father, Chief of Naval Operations Ernest King. And so they were able to plan for that. And they could be optimistic about when they would see each other. A lot of sailors, when they shipped overseas, they wouldn't see their loved one for 2-3 years, I mean, as you well know. And so in some regards, they did have it better. But the support of Catherine and her personality, it does show in these letters. And it's fantastic to see. And I tried to bring that out. And I've also tried to, in other blog posts and things like that, kind of explore some of her contributions to the war, which need to be acknowledged as well.
Now, with these letters being in our archive, how do these letters contribute to our understanding of the wartime experience for high-ranking officers such as him, and particularly in terms of personal burdens and the emotional toll of leadership?
Yeah, the thing I keep coming back to is that personal aspect of it. The letters are very personal insights into Nimitz's character, into his feelings, into his emotions. You know, beyond just the decisions that he made, the campaigns that he planned during the war, this is such a different level. And on the surface, some of them might seem kind of just like a daily rundown of his schedule, or might seem like he's talking about things that are somewhat insignificant, but they really do give you an idea of the things he had to cope with on a daily basis. And not all of them are arduous, and not all of them are life or death or anything like that. You know, there's certain issues that keep cropping up where he's got to handle administrative issues. He's the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, but that also means he's overseeing hundreds of thousands of men and women stationed in Hawaii. And so he's got to deal with local authorities, with military government. And if there's shortages of housing, which there were calamitous, very, very dire shortages of housing during the war, he has to cope with that. He has to find solutions to be a creative problem solver. And so we kind of see that aspect come through too, you know, what things crop up, whether it's issues with drinking or issues with gambling, or fun stuff too. You know, it's fun ceremonies that he enjoys. He enjoyed giving out medals, like in the ceremony with Chief Aviation Ordnanceman John Finn. But Nimitz really, he liked giving out these awards and recognizing sailors for their heroism or their service. For him, the Navy was a team. And so this was one of the best parts of his job. You know, he was actually, I think there was one letter where he might have mentioned signing award certificates or things like that. And he said, you know, my hand hurts, but he says, I'm still invigorated. I'm still in a writing mood, you know, so it cheered him up. And so you kind of get to see his personality and kind of see what really, you know, got him out of bed in the morning.
So what would you say were some of the leadership qualities or most evident from the letters of Nimitz to Catherine?
So there's so much you can talk about when you talk about Nimitz and leadership, but I'll highlight the one that comes to mind. In October 1942, Nimitz had to make a very difficult decision. And oddly enough, based on the surviving letters, it seems like it was one of the hardest decisions he made of the war. And that was to relieve Vice Admiral Robert Gormley of his command in the Southwest Pacific. Gormley was overseeing the command of the Guadalcanal operations. His nickname, Operation Shoestring. This was a very close-run thing. The Japanese were pouring men and planes and ships into this campaign, and it was a battle of attrition is really what it came down to. And Gormley was an effective officer. You know, he didn't make the vice admiral by accident. He was a great administrator, but he was under a ton of strain. He had some health issues. The climate was really affecting his ability. And Nimitz, after much contemplation and discussion with his staff, came to the decision that he needed to relieve Gormley. And we can see in Nimitz's letters that this decision was tough on him because, as I said before, Nimitz felt that the Navy was a team. So he knew that by relieving Gormley, he was hurting this man's career. And this man, just like Nimitz himself, devoted his life to the Navy. And I think it speaks a lot to Nimitz's qualities of empathy when he talks about feeling that he hopes he hasn't made an enemy of Gormley and that he didn't want to do this, but he felt this was what was best for the nation and the Navy, and that must stand above personal considerations. But also in that letter, and I should say Nimitz wrote, and I think he underscored it as well, that to his wife, he's like, I'm telling you this, but you cannot share this with anyone else. This is absolutely, and that speaks to Nimitz's discretion too. Nimitz wouldn't have gone about talking about this to anybody else. And that really shows the trust he placed in Catherine, but also the fact that this was his sole outlet. This is the one person in the world who he could talk about these kind of very personal elements.
How did Nimitz delegate authority? You're talking about him relieving staff members and such. Mm-hmm. How did he build trust among his subordinates?
Well, that's really the biggest question of all, really, right? Is how did Nimitz build a team and how did he create such an effective organization and inspire his men to achieve great things? And this was, I mean, the greatest team that the Navy's really ever seen, the biggest fleet that we've ever put afloat. And I think that the most important thing that Nimitz did in terms of delegating authority was when he sent commanders out with the fleet, when he sent them on a mission, whether it was Admiral Spruance or Admiral Halsey with orders to support a landing force or to seize an island or seize an atoll, he gave them issued written orders, and then he let them go. And once they had sailed over the horizon, Nimitz did not intervene. He monitored the situation closely. He read reports, and he monitored all the radio traffic, but he did not interject his opinions. He did not try to armchair general it from 1,000 miles away. He knew that the admiral or the commander on the scene who he had delegated, who he trusted, was the best qualified to make the decisions. And that it did show the trust that Nimitz had in his subordinates by not questioning, by not having them feel that he was looking over their shoulder. So I think that was a crucial element of his leadership philosophy, I think, was not to micromanage and to impart ultimate authority to those commanders on the scene. Nimitz had a lot of things to worry about early in the war, especially, you know, there was those times that show up in the letters where he was sleepless, where his hands were shaking. But I think when he finally found those admirals, those subordinates who he could trust, and who he put the right people in the right position, and that was crucial. That was also another element of him being a great leader. That helped him sleep a lot better at night, you know, rightfully so. Admiral Spruance, especially, was Nimitz's right-hand man, and it's no accident that he became Nimitz's immediate successor, but then quickly moved on to the Naval War College.
So how could Nimitz leadership principles be applied in today's world for today's Navy warfighter?
Well, I think what I would want readers to take away from Nimitz's leadership style from this book would be, and some of them we've touched on, you know, earlier in this discussion too, but especially the fact that he didn't micromanage, the fact that he kept an open mind, as we talked about with his attitude towards codebreakers and the Battle of Midway, the fact that he wanted to just keep learning as much as he could about all the elements under his command, the fact that he gave second chances and was given second chances in his career. And that, I think, speaks volumes to the kind of leader he was. He was exacting. He was demanding. He expected great things. He once gave a performance evaluation to one of his subordinates, and he said, you know, I've written these things here, but I expect you to live up to them as well. So he had a way of coaxing the best out of his men and without making them fearful of him either. People said that he had a very penetrating gaze, and he could be stern, he could be tough, but he was also empathetic. And I think that's really important. He didn't criticize people in front of others. You know, if he had to critique or to point out something that someone could be doing better, he would do it privately, and he'd do it in a way that would make his subordinates resolve to do their best and to do better. And he was really a champion of his sailors, and not the average sailor, but also his subordinates. He believed the Navy was a team, and so he wanted to build up every member of the team. Nimitz felt that rewards came to those who, in time, who deserved them. And so he felt that there was no need to overinflate your own accomplishments, because eventually you would get recognized. He firmly believed that, and that was why I think he didn't feel the need to try and steal the spotlight. You know, being the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, there was a lot of attention on him to begin with, but he was more than happy to share that and to say, well, yes, I'm the head of the Pacific Fleet, but there's a lot of others here that deserve recognition, that they were the man on the scene and things like that. So that's somewhat different than some of the other leaders you see in World War II, but there were other great leaders as well in the other theaters. But I think that's too why Nimitz's leadership philosophy can still offer a lot to leaders in any position, whether it's the Navy or outside of it.
Well, thank you, Tyler, for coming in today to discuss your book on Admiral Nimitz and these extremely unique letters between him and his wife, Catherine. It certainly provides a specific aspect of his life that I'm sure those who are interested in the Admiral, but also in the war in Pacific, will be excited to read.
Thank you very much, Cliff. It's been a pleasure.
To quickly recap today's podcast, more information, stories, photos, and a free copy of this book about Admiral Nimitz and his World War II letters home, along with resource links, can be found at history.navy.mil. And also within the podcast show notes. Thanks for joining us today on this episode of Always and Forever, Chester, on Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy.